If you open up your sources in your booklets, maybe I'll start with Mary Douglas. It's the quote at the top of your page. I believe that ideas about separating, purifying, demarcating, and punishing transgressors have their main function to impose system on an inherently untidy experience. It's only by exaggerating the difference between within and without, above and below, male and female, with and against, that a semblance of order is created. I want to think together today about a law that relates to a very unorderly time in life, and that is teenagers. And try to follow Mary Douglas's wisdom and to try and see how our law tries to make order in that untidy time of life. Tough children appear in the biblical narrative again and again. We have Cain, we have Noah's sons, we have Avshalom, the son of David. But the classic law regarding these children, these difficult children, appears in Dvarim, in a group of verses known to deal with the wild and unruly child, Ben Sorer Umore. This law raises many questions, comprehensive, interpretive, and also, when we read the later sources, moral questions. And some of those questions I want to address today. I also want to use this law in order to focus on the varied roles that public institutions can play, primarily with dealing with issues that come up in private life. I think that through examining this law, we'll see the court, in the case of the Ben Sorer Umore, the unruly child, can have different roles in how it interacts with this family equation, who it relates to and how it relates to the different characters that take roles in this world. This impacts and also stems from different understandings of the relationship between the public sphere and the private sphere. So we'll also touch on that a little bit. The second point that I want to demonstrate is a really interesting Talmudic phenomena, which is taking issues that come up in private life and broadening them such that they actually relate to society at large. I think Ben Sorer Umore will become an example of such a thing, and maybe we'll even have time to see a few other examples. So let's start by reading the four verses that are at the heart of this discussion. And part of what I want to do is uncover what they have to say, expose what is missing, what they're actually not saying, and through opening up the many different meaning possibilities, the varied possibilities of meaning from these verses, then when we look into the Tanaitic and Amoraitic sources, we will suddenly see the choices that the rabbis make vis-a-vis these verses. Okay, so if we read the verses well and actually expose the varied meanings that might come up there, we'll suddenly realize, the Mishnah here is making a choice about how to read this word. It's not a compelled, necessary reading, but actually maybe a value-based decision. So first, let's just glance at the verses so we all have a picture of them. Ki yeh le'ish ben sorer umore. If a person has a wild and unruly child, enenu shomea bekol aviv uvekol imo. He does not listen to his father and he does not listen to his mother. Ve'yisru oto. They punish him, possibly. We'll have to think about what that word means. Velo ishma alehem, and he doesn't listen to them. I think maybe if you're willing to sit in one of these two sections, then we'll be sitting all together. Thank you. Vetafsu bo aviv ve'imo. They grab him, hold on to him. Vehotziu oto el ziknei iro ve'el shar mekomo. They take him out to the elders, to the place where the elders sit, to the gate. That's usually where the elders sat, where the court sat. Ve'amru el ziknei iro, and they say to the elders, Bneinu ze sorer umore. This is a wild, our son, our child is a wild and unruly child. Eneno shomea bekolenu. He doesn't listen to our voices, doesn't listen to us. Zolel vesove. He is a glutton and a drunkard, maybe. Uregamuhu kol anshei iro beavanim. The people of his town will stone him. Vamet, he will die. Uviarta hara mikirbecha. You will burn the evil out of your midst. Vekol Israel ishmeu veirau. And all of Israel will hear and will fear. I want to focus on three main characters that are in this narrative. First of all, the court, as I said. Second of all, the son, the child. And third of all, the parents. And maybe we can start just having read the verses a little bit. Maybe people can throw out questions. What is clear? What isn't clear from this? From these verses? What questions would you want to ask? Or would you expect the Mishnah and the Talmud to kind of begin responding to when you read these verses? Yes.
How long has this been going on?
How long has it been going on? Great, great. Yes.
The child doesn't have a chance to express himself. It's just assumed that what the parents are saying is right. And also, he's only described as a glutton and drunkard when they talk about it, not in the narrative. So.
Great. I'm going to turn your statements into questions. No, it's fine. I think what you're asking is, what actually happens in the court? Is there room for the child to speak or not? What's their imagination? And you're asking, I think, more broadly, what's the role of the court? Is the court just there to give a rubber stamp to the parents' analysis of the reality, or do they have a bigger function, right? Is it beyond implementation, okay, or not? Great, yes.
What type of discipline was used to try to change the child?
Great, ve'yisruto, the discipline. What is it exactly, okay? What are different possibilities of discipline? Yes. Great, great idea. Okay, great question. Okay, important one. Okay, so let's slowly start reading. So the law starts with the words, ki ye le'ish bin, if a person shall have a child. So as you started saying, these leave more questions than answers. For example, does this law include an orphan or an adopted child? What is the word ben? What type of relationship does it actually signify? Okay? The gender question is also important here. Is there a gender bias to this word? And this question actually goes both to the parents and on to the children. Okay? Now, what does the parents, what is the environment in which the child is growing up here? What is it, and does it make a difference, right? What does the parents' marriage look like? Does that make a difference to the status of this child as a sorer? The main thing that is clear is that the verse stems, the law stems from the relationship between the parents and the children here, okay? The word ben here signifies maybe some genetic connection, maybe some historic connection, but the word ben here is about the relationship to the ish. Ki ye le ish ben. These two are connected. The relationship is significant because, as we see from other laws in the Torah, actions that are done in different contexts can have different implications. Okay, so the same behavior can be understood in different ways and also have different implications legally, if they're done within a familial relationship or not. For example, on page 2, on the top of the page, you see the law about hitting parents. Makeh aviv ve'imo mot yumat. If somebody hits their parents, they deserve the death penalty. On the other hand, further on, close by in that chapter, ki yerivun anashim, if there is a fight, vehika ishet re'eu, and one hits the other, shivto yiten verapo yirapeh. You have to pay some monetary value to help the healing, maybe the amount of time the person can't work, but for sure it's not the death penalty, like it is in the context of parents and children. So what makes a big difference here is the context in which it's done, and we also feel it from the number of times that the aviv ve'imo repeat themselves again and again, enenu shomea bekol aviv ve'imo. Okay? Now, two additional questions I think are left open in these words. First of all, does it have to be in front of both parents? Okay? Does he have to misbehave, not listen to both his parents? Or should we actually read the ve, the and here, as meaning or, okay? Which is one of the meanings of the word. Another question that remains open is the question of the responsibility of the parents to their acts, to their children's, to their child's behavior, okay? Is there any realm where that question comes up? Does it come up in the court? Okay, the role that the parents might play in how their child is acting, or is that completely disregarded in his behavior? Now let's move on to the word ben, the son. So in Hebrew, it's a very vague word. Similar, I think, to son in English, to the way it's used, right? It can be used sometimes where a parent tells their child, come here, son. But it's also often used just to define a youth, right? Somebody young, not necessarily in the relationship of parent and offspring. And as you asked, the age of this child isn't stated in the verses. And it's interesting that we even assume that there should be an age, because maybe this is a law that pertains to any one of us at any age when we're acting in this way towards our parents, okay? In the Roman law, pastros potestas, there was the father, the strong father who was in charge of the clan, and the clan included his children, their spouses, their children, their slaves, and so on. And it was only with the death of that father that anyone got independence or freedom from that relationship. And one of the things that father could do in Roman society was kill their child for misbehaving, okay, without a court's involvement necessarily. Yes.
Marker, it's interesting in terms of what we learned this morning, if you ignore sort of the rabbinic restriction on the age, if you take any age, the halakha goes completely against it, because it says that in most cases we don't have to obey our parents. So this ain't enu shomea, he's not listening to us in the sense of obeying us or something has been completely obviated by the halakha.
Great. So I want to say two things in response, okay? The first is maybe this law contradicts some of the laws that we saw this morning. And maybe here there is an expectation of simple obedience, okay? Also, already this morning, Shai mentioned that there's a spectrum of opinions, okay, about the degree to which individuality should come into our relationship with our parents, okay? I think it's pretty clear that in the biblical narrative, we're talking about, when we say ben, we mean the person who is the offspring of this ish, okay? Let us turn to the Mishnah now, and then ask ourselves the implication of what you're asking, okay? So the Mishnah chooses to define the word ben in a very different way. The Mishnah opens with the question, me'ematai. And you have it at the top of page 3. No, wait, let's find the Mishnah. Yeah, the second source on page 2. Okay? And we can read the Mishnah together and see what it does with the word ben. Ben Sorer Umore, the title of the chapter. Me'ematai na'asa ben Sorer Umore? From what point does a child become a Sorer Umore? Mishe yavi shte se'arot ve'ad sheyakif zakan. From the moment that he brings two pubic hairs until he has full pubic hair. Hatachton velo elyon, unless you convince the word beard, you confuse the word beard, they make it clear we're talking about the lower beard. Ela shedibru chachamim belashon nekiya, but the rabbis speak in clean language. as it says, ki ye le'ish ben velo bat. So the Mishnah reads the verses as talking only about boys. Ben velo ish, we're not talking about adults. Katan patur shelo ba lichlal mitzvot. A minor is exempt because he is not obligated at all. So when the Mishnah asks from what point a child is eligible to become a sorer, its answer is not actions. Okay? It doesn't describe the activities, the lack of listening that this child does, but actually the physiological development point of when a child can become eligible to become a sorer. So from the moment that there's two pubic hairs, and it's a short period of time, actually there is a biological disagreement here between the Babylonian and the Jerusalem, the Palestinian Talmud. The Bavli says, Kol yamav shel ben sorer u'more, the days of a ben sorer u'more that it takes for this physiological development is 3 months. Whereas the Palestinian Talmud says, no, it's actually 6 months. Okay, but we're talking about a short period of time. So the Mishnah's definition of ben is much more exact than the one of the Torah, though it's still relative, right? Because children develop at different ages and in different speeds and so on. It's slightly more objective than the one in the Torah, okay? But it's not as objective as it would have been if we would have gotten an age, for example, okay? So there was a spectrum here of where the Mishnah could have gone. Yes?
Just a question about that last line, about why a minor is exempt, because they're not at the age of responsibility for mitzvot. That seems like an interesting way. I guess there's something that's not quite gelling about that, and is it that they need to know that they are responsible in this mitzvah? So it's not a kind of, it's not a statement about developmental, like, oh yeah, adolescence, that's what it's about, is rebelling. It's sort of about having full knowledge of the legal territory that you're entering into. Is that why a minor is exempt?
Can you flesh out why you're saying that it's not about rebelling?
Well, because it seems like when they say a minor is exempt for he has not entered the category of being obligated in mitzvot, then to me the implication is that only once you are responsible in al mitzvot do you become responsible in to sort of know this is what you have coming to you if you don't listen to your father and mother, correct?
Yeah.
Is that right? So it's not really about a developmental stage, it's about almost kind of like knowing your Miranda rights.
Great,
you know,
great.
As it was.
So something very interesting happens in the Talmud. And it's actually, we see it already in earlier Tanaitic sources. There's actually a equating of physiological, physical development with how we understand children to be of mind, to be able to understand, okay? We see it in laws that have to do with marriage, okay? From what age can you take significant legal action about your status? And that's a realm where we say, well, obviously, understanding and physical development need to go hand in hand to be able to do such a step, okay? And actually, in the context of Ben Sorer U'More, the way the Talmud defines his knowledge ability is that he understands the meaning of, he is able to do evil with intention, okay? With intention to do evil, okay? That that when you're at the stage, mezid v'mazria, mezid is the ability to do evil on purpose, and mazria is when you have sperm that can procreate, okay? And the two are equated, okay? In the context of the sorer. Yes.
So is this passage also saying that the parents can't take the kid to the elders because he is not of the age to follow the commandment, or he has no sense of obligation? So does that mean he doesn't have to
Great. So what this Mishnah is doing is putting the sorer in a very, very specific liminal moment of development, right? He is set up to be exactly in between. Now, I think in two different realms. One, physically, right? He's not a katan. He's not a child. Because if he would do the same deeds as a minor, they would have no significance in the sense of this law. Okay? And if he would do them as an adult, they would have no significance in the sense of this law. Okay? So physically. And also legally. Okay? This is a youth who, to a certain degree, is already held accountable. Like you're saying, he is no longer a katan patur, a minor who is exempt, right? But on the other hand, there is this father or parent who can come in and veto his activities to the degree that they can put him to death. Okay? So he's he's not yet a mature adult who has total freedom to do whatever he wants. Okay? So he is in a very liminal stage. And again, we'll read Mary Douglas here for 1 minute. I think she has a lot of wisdom in explaining this. It's back in on the first page is the second paragraph. She says the following thing about liminal situations. Danger lies in transitional stages simply because transition is neither one state nor the next. It is undefinable, okay? Which is obvious, but also I think really demonstrates the danger. To say that the boys risk their lives says precisely that to go out of the formal structure and to enter the margins, right, this liminal space, is to be exposed to power that is enough to kill them or make their manhood. Okay, now she's talking about other cultures, but how fitting it is for us also, right? If they push through this teenage age of sorer, they will either be put to death or they will survive and they will become grown-ups. Okay, very telling. Yes.
In reading this portion, I mean, I guess as a parent, there's nothing talking about obedience here. The focus is that they're wild and defiant, and they can't handle him. Mm-hmm. And because they can't handle him, he doesn't obey. But so to me, going to the elders is because this kid is out of control. So is that a 21st,
great.
Modern thinking?
Give it a few minutes and we'll get to the role of the court, okay? Because I think you're really defining one of the roles and we'll see if there's possibly a few others, okay? A couple of more things to emphasize just with the move from the Torah understanding of the word bin as being relationship to the Mishnah understanding of the word bin as being a specific age. So there's an aspect that is narrowing and an aspect that is broadening in this move. There's almost a rabbinic chutzpah here in such a limiting of this law, okay? Placing it on a child for 3 to 6 months, okay? This is really like an uprooting almost of what the Torah tries here to impose. On the other hand, it enables us to read the word bin outside of the relationship altogether. And maybe it's suggesting that this is now a rule about any youth acting in this way towards any adult. In other words, once I've taken the word bin out of its familial relationship, suddenly maybe this is a law that pertains to society at large. Okay, and says this is how we treat children in general, not only when they are our offspring, but in general when they are misbehaving. Okay, beyond the constraints of family.
But still only mother and a father can bring.
So you're right that the verses very strongly are reading in the parents, but the Tanaitic opening Mishnah doesn't give them room at all. Okay, they will appear much later in the chapter. Okay, and in the Amoraitic discussion, they appear much, much later. Okay, the implication is that if initially the punishment took place in the public sphere, now maybe the Mishnah is suggesting that the actions of the child are also taking place in the public sphere. Okay, we've completely moved the scene of where this misbehaving happens. We're no longer in the family, and we've now completely moved to the public. I'll just say in parentheses that there are other laws where this happens. For example, the isha hasota, a woman who's being accused by her husband for having a relationship with another man. The Torah clearly is talking about a marital relationship and the husband accusing his wife. When we start looking into the Tannaitic sources, suddenly there's a midrash that says, oh yeah, the neighbor can also complain about her behavior. Okay? And it becomes, I see some of your heads shaking, it becomes really a law that is about policing women in general in society. Okay? And I wonder if something similar is happening here when it comes to children. One last thing to note about the move to the Mishnah. Judith Hauptmann makes an interesting claim, which I think is also relevant here. She says that women, and I think also children, are treated in the Torah as part of a collective, as part of this collective called family, and that there's a shift in Tannaitic sources to treat them as individuals. Okay? And I wonder if we see the same exact thing happening here also with the child, whereas in the Torah, he is an entity within a family, and all his actions are understood and get meaning and significance within that little discrete unit. And the rabbis are pushing away, peeling off the family unit and saying, wait a minute, this youth is an individual. And then his actions have meaning towards any other individual in society, and that will have implications on society at large, almost skipping over the stage of the family itself. Okay. So just to summarize, we saw two different meanings of the word ben, one in the Bible and one in the Mishnah, one focusing on relationship and the other focusing on age. We said this limits who we see the Torah is talking about, because maybe it's talking only about this teenager who's in this very, very specific developmental age. And on the other hand, that enables us to broaden it to the broad society, to say that it's maybe talking about any child in society relating in that way to any adult. And one implication is that the action is now understood in the broad context of society and not only as affecting his parents or his father if we're in a patriarchal environment. Okay, if there are no other comments, we'll take one step forward. So let's go back to the verses. There are three pairs of words that try to define what this child is doing inappropriately, right? The first pair is sorer umore, wild and unruly. The second is eneno shomea, doesn't listen. And the third is zolel vesove, glutton and drunkard. Let's start with the word sorer. We find it in the Bible in general, in the Tanakh, in different contexts, and different contexts lend different meanings. Okay, one initial interpretation to the word is to diverge, to swerve, to move away from the word sar. So it's one who doesn't go in the path that is prescribed to them. You have it on page 3, the second. It's number 4. It's the second Hebrew verse there. Ebran be'artzecha, Israel is asking to go through a land. Baderech baderech elech, I will walk straight on the path that you prescribe to me. Lo asur yamin usmol, I won't asur, sorer, to the right or to the left. I won't swerve. One of the midrashe halacha suggests, why, what does it mean that he's a sorer? Shemore le'atzmo derech acheret. That he gives himself a new path. And the word they use to describe it is min, which is a idolater. Okay? So the commentary tries to suggest that he's specifically carving himself a new religious path. But maybe it's the aspect of innovation that is so jarring about this child's behavior, okay? Rather than doing what his parents are telling him to do, he's doing something new and different, and that feels unbearable to society. Yes?
And mean may be more threatening because it's not just an oved avodah zarah, but the word mean can imply like a Judeo-Christian. So that's really threatening. It's scary because it's within. It's chidush from within. So that's...
You're right, and this is a Tanaitic source, so it's really the beginning of dealing with Christianity, okay? Yes, okay? So, and I guess part of the question I'm left with, is this a specific behavior that is threatening, dafka Christianity, dafka min, or is there a type of behavior here that is threatening?
Where is that source?
The source is in the, it's in one of the Midrashei Halacha, in the Sifri. A second different understanding of the word sorer is mainly the act of saying no. He is rejecting. He is refusing. Okay, you have it in your second source. Vayema'anu lehakshiv, they refuse to listen. Vayitnu katef soreret. Okay, they present a shoulder that is saying no, a negative shoulder. Okay, katef soreret. Ve'oznam hechbidu mishmoa, and their ear is heavy in such a way that they are refusing to listen. Okay, so the main action here described in this verse of the word sorer is a rejection and negation. Very often, these terms sorer and moreh are borrowed for the relationship between God and Israel when Israel are being criticized for their actions. Ho banim sorerim, oh you sorer sons, you unruly sons. You don't take advice from me, la'asot etza velo meni, you refuse to take my advice, and so on and so forth. And maybe it's hinting specifically at a refusal that the meaning of lehakshiv is to take the advice of the parents, to take the guidance of the parents. That is a refusal that this boy is doing. And I wonder if this negation is understood as a negation of the unique relationship between the parents and the children. So the refusal to accept something special, as you are people who have a special relationship with me, and so I'm expected to listen to you in a different way than I do to others. Let's move for a minute to the word more. The word more has two central meanings. Some of you in the room know the first one well personally, and that is to be a teacher, hora'a, to direct, to guide. Right, we use it as pointing, but we also use it as teaching and learning. Like the verse that you have at the bottom of your pages from Mishlei, Velo shamati bekol morai, I haven't listened to my teachers, okay, to the ones who direct me and who guide me. And the other one, the other meaning of the word is revolt. Mer, you are coming up in revolt against me. I think when we put these two together, we have a completing picture of a child who is trying to seize control in an inappropriate way. Okay, he's trying to guide and direct and revolting in that way because it's inappropriate for him to be in control of a home. So these three different interpretations of the word sorer umore really lend themselves to three different narratives about what this child might be doing. Okay, in the first one, the main action, the main direction that his activity is going is a negation. Eneno shomer, refusing to listen and possibly negating the unique relationship between parent and child. The second one is an attempt to be in control, and that's threatening because he's trying to uproot social order. Okay, it's not appropriate for a child to be in control. And the third one is that the main thing he's doing is going to a new place. Okay, he's doing something novel and disregarding the parents in that way. Yes?
Maybe you don't want to go back, but I wanted to go back to the Mishnah because I'm just troubled by the premise that what the Mishnah is doing is putting this in a public sphere, taking it out of the family, because I just don't see that. What I see the Mishnah doing, at least here, the text we have here, is narrowing the category.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how you would do that in a different way. And if they're really narrowing the category, it's not their interest to make it a public sphere, but limited to the family. So they're just focusing on one word and using that as a way to make this less likely. And that, to me, doesn't take it out of the family context. And then
yeah.
You still have here, kibye le'ish ben. So it's still that relationship is in the Mishnah.
Yes. Look, your question is good, and you're in good company. Many, especially modern researchers, claim that the main goal of the rabbinic texts regarding sorer umore is to limit it to the degree of absurdum and to make it impossible and unimplementable. I'll get back a little later to the unimplementability of this law, okay? And yet, I want to suggest that when you decide to read the word bin as defining age, you're opening up the possibility of putting this child out of the specific relationship and acting in society. You're right that the verse is quoted there, but I actually think that a lot of the Tanaitic and Talmudic discussions push us to read it in a broader way. I'll give you one upside-down way that it's done as an example. In the Talmudic discussion, there suddenly comes up an assumption that actually came up in Ethan's class now, which it was amazing to hear him say it. He said, the rabbis discuss a situation, and then one of the rabbis comes up and says, "V'chiyesh lecha adam b'Yisrael she'en lo goalim?" Is there a person among Israel who doesn't have a distant family member? Everyone has some distant family member. Okay? Now, when found in the heart of this discussion, placing all of Israel as one big family basically means that it doesn't matter towards whom I'm acting in this way. I'm always acting towards an elder in my family. So I think the Talmud does it in both ways, both by taking the bin out of the familial and into the broad, enabling the broad society, but also by turning all of Israel into one big family. And then everything that happens there happens in that way. Okay, but that's just another example in which the Talmud does it. Okay. A couple of other points that come up in the verses. V'yisru oto, I think somebody here asked, how exactly are they punishing him? V'yisru oto ve'lo yishma aleihem, and they punish him and he doesn't listen to them. I think there's two different ways to read these words in the verse. One, the question is how we understand the title versus the detailing. We can see the title of the verses being, ki yeh le'ish ben sorer umore, if a person has a child who's wild and unruly, enenu shomea b'kol aviv v'kol imo, he doesn't listen to his parents. And now comes the description. What's the description? They punish him and he doesn't listen. Okay? A very narrow description of what happens. But we can also read the title as a little bit shorter, right? If we read the title as only being, if a person should have a wild and unruly child, ki yeh le'ish ben sorer umore, and now comes the detailing description. And what's the description? Enenu shomea, he doesn't listen, ve'yisru oto, and they punish him, ve'lo yishma alehem, and he again doesn't listen. Okay, then the case suddenly becomes a child who's doing this activity again and again and again. Okay, and a different read of what it means. Say one word about zolel v'sove. Zolel is eating in a boundaryless way. Sove usually relates not so much to a drunk, but to somebody who's drinking without boundaries. Okay, so there's a description here of somebody who almost in a little bit of a disgusting way is consuming with no boundaries. And it's not clear to us why. In other words, it could be that this is a child who's disregarding norms of society, right? Everyone takes one portion and he takes four, okay? Because he doesn't care, or he just doesn't have inhibitions internally, okay? Not because of something malicious, mazid, not because of some malicious aspect, but because he doesn't have them, or maybe some combination of both, and they lend slightly different character to what this child might be doing. There's two opposite extremes in researchers of how they relate to these two words. On the one hand, which is the direction that you're pointing to, those who want to read the whole point of the later law as narrowing who this child is and the scope of his behavior say that really only a child who is a drunk and a glutton can be put under the guise of this law. Okay, it's only that behavior. Actually, some of the laws we saw this morning of kalel, cursing your parent, they want to also narrow down to this specific behavior. claiming that this becomes the model of a child who's misbehaving towards his parents, and only a child who fits this exact model is going to be put to death. Okay, the opposite extreme, which Elizabeth Bellefontaine is one of the Bible researchers who claims this, makes the following suggestion. We suggest that this second accusation, the solel vesoveh of the drunkenness, I think, I'm not sure you have it on your pages, it's not long, reflects an originally independent situation from the first. It is the remains of a tribal customary law dealing with thoroughly corrupt members of a clan or tribe. Okay, in other words, she claims that there are really two laws that were glued here together, one pertaining to the tribe and the other to the family. Whether we agree with her reading or not, what's interesting about it is that she is sensitive to the mixture here of realms between private and public, okay? And she tries to pull them apart with her suggestion. Now let's give some attention to the court. V'tafsu bo aviv v'imo, they take him. Ve'otziu oto el ziknei ro, they take him out to the elders. Ve'el sha'ar mekomot, to the gate of his city, to the gate of his town. First of all, there's innovation here just vis-a-vis biblical law and narrative itself. We have several examples in the Torah itself where parents don't take their misbehaving children out to court, but actually decide to kill them themselves. Okay, you have them on the back of your page. One of them is Reuven. Reuven, with his brothers, wants to go back down to Egypt to bring food for Yaakov and for the family. And Yaakov says, you can't take Binyamin. But Yosef said, you have to bring Binyamin or you can't come. And Reuven says the following to his father. Vayomer Reuven el aviv. Reuven says to his father, le'emor et shnei banai tamit. My two sons you can kill. Im lo avienu elecha. If I don't return Binyamin, if I don't return Binyamin to you. Okay, now we could say that it's rhetoric, but possibly he actually thought that he could do it. Another great example is Yehuda, who says about Tamar, his daughter-in-law, not his daughter in this case, but his daughter-in-law, hotzi'uha v'tisaref. Right? Seemingly he has the authority to say that. I have to say that there are midrashim who claim that he was actually the head of the court. Do you want me to remind you the context?
No, I know.
Okay, right? He finds her pregnant not from his son, okay? Actually, it turns out to be his children, but we'll leave that for another time, okay? And the third, example is, of course, Avraham with Akedat Yitzchak. Okay, so all these verses show that possibly in the biblical context, there's a lot of innovation in just saying you have to take this out to the court. You parents don't have the ability to make these decisions by yourselves. Yes.
It seems to be in this strange place between court and private. Just extra.
What's the it?
Oh, that's the way, I don't know, the way at least we're trying to read Pshat into the biblical telling of Ben Sorer or Moreh, right? Because they're not saying there's going to be trial. There's no trial, really. There's no judge and jury. There's no going through a case. I witnesses, there's just the fact that it's meted out by Zikin, by like the elders of the town. Say.
Great. So I think
it's a weird somewhere in between those two things.
So I think, like before, I want to suggest turning your statement into a question just in order to flesh out the different possibilities here, okay? One possibility is, which I think is the one you're suggesting, is we are narrowing the role of the court to implementation. Deciding that this child is a sorer has already happened by his parents, okay? There is no trial here in the sense of decision-making. There is just almost a rubber stamp and implementation of the death penalty. Okay, that would be a narrow read of the role of the court. A much broader read would say the court actually has the power to decide if this is a ben sorer o moreh or not. In other words, since we're not told what happens there, possibly the hotzi'uhu is if he is a ben sorer o moreh, but he might turn out not to be that ben sorer o moreh, right? And then the end will be different. Now, I think there's another question here about the role of the court. Do we see the court as mandated or not? In other words, say I have a ben sorer o moreh, and I open the Torah to tell me what to do. When does the description end and the verdict begin? Is the description, if you have a ben sorer o moreh, he does this and this, you punish him, he does it again, you decide to take him out to the court, then kill him? Or is the description, you have a ben sorer o moreh, he's doing all these things, the verdict is, I must take him out to the court. Okay? Which I think also an interesting difference in how we perceive it. In other words, is it almost like the social worker who's mandated by the state to come into a home when there is problems going on there, okay, or not? Or is this a choice in the hand of the parents, which I think relate to some of the questions that were asked here about the role that the court can play in these situations? Yes.
Is there ever a case of the way parents deal with children that's deemed inappropriate? Like, is anybody questioning it? Like, maybe the child is defiant because the parents are parenting the child in an unreasonable way. Or is that not ever thought about?
Wonderful. So the Mishnah actually speaks of parents being re'uyim, worthy of each other, fitting for each other. It's hard. Now, they quickly go to a legal meaning of the word ra'ui, but it opens up the question that you're asking. And there's a lot of what I would call non-normative families that are taken out of the law. For example, if the parent is a minor, even if his child is a sorer, you can't implement the law. According to the Mishnah and the Talmud, the Talmudic discussion, okay, and so on. And I wonder if the discussion and the collection of the non-normative families that are slowly taken out of the law is actually a way to have the conversation you're raising of when there's an inappropriate environment which almost lends itself to a ben sorer o moreh, we don't implement the law. Okay, so I think the questions come up in that way in the later discussion. Great. Okay. So there's one more piece, and that is how we can understand the role of the court. And I think there's three different ways to understand the role of the court, which maybe become models, and Debbie's heard some version of this, which become models to think of the role of institutions. Of institutions in general.
Just a clarifying question.
Yes.
Going back to the question you raised here, it sounded like from Dvarim, there is no necessary court. That's all Tanaitic, right? I mean, this is like a gang of elders.
Well, yes.
Stoning the kid, essentially, or at least the people in stoning the kid.
Finish your question.
Iro are going to stone him, and. The language of court, is that introduced in the Mishnah? Because otherwise I don't.
Great.
It's
so,
not obvious.
So yes, it's introduced in the Mishnah, but I also want to say that it's very accepted to read the terms kenim as a court. Okay? Yes. Okay? In other words, it's elders with the role that they sit with, right? With the hats that they wear as members of the court, and also the place that the court often sat was at the gate of the city. Okay, so both those descriptions kind of lead us to read this as the court. Okay?
You said if the parent is a minor?
How does that work?
Finish your sentence. How does that work?
If we're talking about this case, then if this kid already has to be not a minor anymore, then how could his parent be a minor?
Fantastic. The Gemara really wants to know. So now the Gemara goes into this amazing discussion of whether or not children can have children. Okay? And that you'll have to come next year. Okay? Yeah. Yofi, we've now laid out the entire Talmudic discussion. okay. So I want to suggest three models of how to understand the role of the court here. Okay. The first is to actually see the court, which maybe you were hinting at, I'm not sure, as a place where parents and children actually have the opportunity to meet each other. Maybe the court is not there to give a verdict, but actually to kind of enable the relationship to be fixed, the relationship to stand in the center. And I think the way this happens is because the court, by definition, is a different context. In other words, imagine a kid is refusing to do homework. And the kid comes home and the parent says, "You have to do your homework." And the kid says, "I'm not doing my homework." And the parent says, "You have to do your homework or there'll be no computer time today." And the kid says, "I hate you," and slams the door. Now, that has become a scene about the relationship between the parents and the child. Okay, the next day, they go to school, and the parent says, "The kid won't do homework." And the teacher turns to the kid and says, "What's going on? Why won't you do homework?" And the kid says, "I'm so tired when I get home, and I can't do my homework." And the teacher says, "Well, you know what? Maybe let's flip it around and first spend some time on the computer and then do your homework. And let's also limit your homework time to 15 minutes a day, no more than that. What do you think about that, dear parent?" Suddenly, because the context is no longer the home, but the school, the revolt of the kid, the refusal of the kid to do homework, is understood in a totally different way. It's no longer his pushing his parents, but actually his refusing to his teacher. And the different context enables to actually see the relationship that's happening at home also in a different light. Yes.
The problem I have with that is that here it says that, let's see, they shall say the elders of this town, the son of ours is disloyal and defiant, he does not heed us, he's a glutton and drunkard, thereupon the men of his town shall stone to death. Who wants to take a chance of bringing their child to a court and presenting this and the court deciding?
Right.
Now, in we might be able to look back now and say, well, the court never killed anybody. You know, that was generally, you know, there was never a case in which it was so extreme that they killed someone. But if this is what's presented to you, that you can't control your child and you're not getting along, why would you even take a chance of letting it go to the court and then for the court to say, "You're right, this kid, let's stone him." So,
great question. Do you want to relate to the question?
Yes, because I think unfortunately right now we have seen very contemporary issues of this. Of parents who know their children are dangerous. You know, the kid went and shut up on the schools. The parents said, "What do? When we tried to go to the court or someone, there was no one who could enforce anything." And so having a place where there could be some adjudication, some chance to talk, some chance to get the kid's attention, make your time, you know, unfortunately, maybe this is a very vital.
I still doubt there was a social worker.
Yes.
So I agree with that today. I definitely agree with that. But in the description that they give about someone who is, you know, who is Sorer Moré, or, you know, he's Zolel the Sove, it doesn't say in particular that this is a child who's dangerous to others. So why wouldn't they say, if you have a child who is so out of control that you think he's dangerous to others, bring him to the court, and we will work that. Because that's very specific, and that is true. There are people who have dangerous children, and they try to get the courts to intervene. And I agree with that. You want to get the courts to, but it doesn't describe the child being out of control in that way. I mean,
Great. Yes.
It's interesting. I thought that sort of the end where it says V'chol Yisrael Yishmu V'yirah, it almost seems like, I have no idea, but maybe Tvarim is very concerned with social order. It almost seems like they want to, like, it's almost like death penalty advocates, like they believe in the deterrent effect. And so it seems sort of like Tvarim almost wants to have a Ben Sarah Marer because kids listen to parents and, you know, we'll have one or two cases and, you know, harmony will ensue. I mean, the rabbi seems to be not cool with that, but that's, I mean, the pasuk seems to be very looking forward to it.
Great. I'm going to present the patriarchal view of the court in 1 minute, okay? But I want to make a suggestion vis-a-vis your question. In this model of understanding the court, where the role, the primary role of the court is to create different contexts so that the actions have different meaning, and then both the relationship initially can be fixed, but also we can almost avoid the end, the inevitable death penalty. There's one of the most famous Talmudic statements from this chapter is, Ben sorer umore lo haya velo atid liot. A wild and unruly child never was and never will be. Okay? Now, that is where interpretations like the one you were suggesting come up, to claim that the main goal of the chapter is to minimize the implicability of this law. But I wonder if it's making the following suggestion. Dear parents, if you listen to what the Torah says, and you have a wild and unruly child at home, and then you take him out to the court, by definition, his actions will no longer be sorer umore. Because sorer umore is something that happens at home. And so the taking him out, in the direction that you were going, and so taking him out to a different environment will change the meaning of his actions. And then you can start dealing with it. So I wonder if this...
But then why do they talk about the death penalty? Why don't they go more into that, bring him to the court? I mean, they really jump to an extreme. Like...
It's so great. So let's read the... Let's offer the next... the next narrative of how we can understand the role of the court. Because I think they're different, and I think we in life actually have a choice regarding which one of those roles of institutions we wanna utilize our institutions around us to do. Okay, so let's think of the next two for a minute, and then we can try and play the relationship between them a little better. I'll just note that this understanding of the court utilizes the distinction between the private and the public, right? It says we're going to take advantage of the fact that in life there are different spheres. We're going to take something that's happening in the private, move it into the public, and by that move, we're going to be able to understand what's happening differently and treat it, okay? But that might be a naive read, okay? And I think Rabbi Yoshia is going to help us think of two different models. So on page 4, you have the following source. It appears in a few different places. We'll read it from Masechet Sota. That makes the following interesting equation. De'amar Rabbi Yoshia. Shlosha dvarim sachli ze'ira mi'anshei Yerushalayim. Rabbi Yoshia says, ze'ira, the little one, of the people of Jerusalem, told me, whispered to me, these following three things. Ba'al shemachal al kinuyo, kinuyo machul, a husband who forgives his jealousy, okay? His kinuy in the context of a isha sota, of a woman who he's accusing of having relations with another man. If he forgives, then his jealousy is indeed forgiven, and she doesn't get the death penalty. Okay? Zaken mamre, sheratzu bet din limcholo, mochalim lo. A zaken mamre is a talmid chacham, a wise man, a student of stature, who is prescribing halakha, prescribing law, in opposition to the Sanhedrin, in opposition to the high court, okay? And the statement of Ze'ira here is that if the court wants to pardon him, they are allowed to pardon him and not give him the death penalty. Ve'ben sorer umoreh, and a wild and unruly child, sheratzu aviv ve'imo limcholo, whose parents want to forgive him, absolve him, they can do that. Mochalim lo. Okay? Now, at an initial read, the equating of the mother, wife, and child are pretty obvious. And it's the same figure, right? The father figure who can forgive them both and redeem them or decide to give them life. But putting in the same breath also the court maybe is a little bit surprising. Kate Millett, when she describes patriarchy, gives the following description. A man will control a woman, and an older man will control the younger men, the men who are younger than him. Okay, and that's the definition of patriarchy. Now, actually, she goes on to define the role that the family plays within patriarchy. And she basically defines family as a patriarchal unit within a patriarchal whole. Totally seeing the family and the way it functions as another institution of the bigger institutions around. You have the next quote in your packets. The chief contribution of the family in patriarchy is the socialization of the young, largely through the example and admonition of their parents, into patriarchal ideology. Okay, so that is the role of the family. And she continues, cooperation between the family and the larger society is essential, else both would fall apart. Okay, surprising, interesting. The fate of the three patriarchal institutions, the family, society, and the state, are interrelated. I'll say in parentheses that one person who demonstrates that very strongly is Memuchan. Memuchan is Achashverosh slave, servant. And when Vashti revolts against Achashverosh and refuses to come to his party, Memuchan says, this is going to be the end of society. Okay, and he understands, or he at least has the outlook of Kate Millett, and he understands that if there's a break in one little family, there's a total crumbling of the entire patriarchal society. So all social order is threatened by this child who is revolting against their father, which is why the hand of the court is going to go from the public sphere right into the private sphere and make sure that order is restored within that little family, because otherwise the entire society is being threatened to fall apart. So a strengthening of this little father by the court is critical for society at large, which I think is the way you were suggesting to read Dvarim. Okay, we want to demonstrate this. Now, I have to say one turn of possibility, and that is, in order to demonstrate, if I'm the patriarch and the father, in order to demonstrate my power, it's true that I can kill, but I can also pardon. All the power is in my hand, which might be what Zaira here is suggesting. It doesn't really matter if the court, the father, the husband actually kill or if they pardon. In any case, they can demonstrate, they do demonstrate by whatever action they decide to do, their powers and abilities. Yes.
So in this case, clearly the mother has the same power. In fact, she has a veto. If both parents have to provide the nafila, and the court does not have the power, the state does not have the power to provide this, only the father and the mother.
Right, so look, the... Kate Millett discusses a little bit the role of the mother because you assume that she's part of the family. And there's also a discussion that the Talmud and Mishnah have and that it's worthwhile having here about the role of the mother. I don't want to say too much about it. I just want to say that it's... What I do want to say is the following. It's not clear to me if the mother actually has veto power and her own voice, or if she's only used as a rubber stamp, okay? And for sure from these verses, it's not sufficient. We don't know, right? I sometimes think about it in religious environments where there's free elections. We'll get in 1 minute to that type of criticism, but people who don't have freedom, is it correct to assume their freedom or not? In other words, when a rabbi says to his congregants who follow him blindly, who to vote for, do we say that they have freedom? Even if they went into that ballot by themselves, I don't know. So, and I wonder in that regard, also the role of women in patriarchy. it's hard to judge the degree of freedom, okay? Even when they are given a voice. Okay, so that's a second, maybe more expected way of reading these verses, is to kind of see them as fostering patriarchy, and that's the main role of the court here. But there's a last and opposite stance of the court that I think Rabbi Yoshia might be hinting at. And like Kate Millett suggests a blurring of the distinction between private and public, but actually might suggest a different look. Catherine MacKinnon very strongly criticizes the separation between the private and the public, but she does it from very different reasons to Kate Millett. MacKinnon actually stems from a discussion of the court decision regarding abortion and criticizes the legitimacy of abortion, basing it on privacy. And her claim is that privacy assumes a whole array of assumptions that actually aren't true to all the members of those who are in the private and are not seen. It assumes some amount of freedom, some amount of equality, some amount of power. For example, in the context of abortion, it assumes you have some money, okay? And all those to the weaker elements of society aren't necessarily prevalent and accessible. And her claim is that when we maintain those two distinctions, we're actually ignoring the weaker elements in society. I brought you a short quote from her at the bottom. The liberal ideal of the private holds that so long as the public does not interfere, autonomous individuals interact freely and equally. And her main questioning is whether women in our context, children, are actually autonomous and have the power to do what they want. She advocates an interference of the public into the private, but actually in order to make sure that the weaker elements in society are seen and are heard. Her read will suggest that the main role of the court is to see the child, because to make sure that there isn't a wild, furious parent who's all-powerful, who's going to put his child to death because his kid said no. Okay? And that the role of institutions is to actually see the weaker elements, see the ones who don't have a voice, and to hear them out. Okay, that's the prouder reads of the biblical law here, and also the ones that compare it both to the laws of the Near East that are parallel to the Torah, and even more the ones that equated with Roman law, where still the father had so much power, have like a modern Jewish pride in the fact that here the power of the father, the power of the patriarch, is being limited by the court. So I'll summarize, and then we can open up for questions. The first model was one which suggested that the main function that the court plays is creating different context, new context. What happened in the private now has completely different meanings simply because it's happening in a different place. The second model suggested that when this child comes home and says, I don't want to do homework, the mother picks up the phone to the teacher and says, my child doesn't want to do homework. And the teacher says, then you give him double the homework and you don't let him have cake for dessert, okay? And just strengthens the parent's voice of doing that homework. And in our context, just strengthens the social structure that already exists. The third model suggests that the teacher at the other end of that phone will say, did your kid have a break today? Did he have a snack when he came home? How long has he already been sitting doing his homework? And the role of that outside public eye is to see things that within the private realm you might have missed and you didn't necessarily see and notice. there were four things that I wanted to demonstrate today. One was just the different possibilities, the different narratives of where the sorer might be going. We suggested three, either that he's just saying no, or that he's trying to control, or that he's kind of carving for himself a new path. We discussed a little bit the different roles that the court might be playing. We discussed the implications on that about the distinction between private and public, and a little bit the gains and losses of maintaining those two as separate or actually blurring the lines between those two. And the last thing I suggested was that maybe the word bin, in the way that the Mishnah begins to interpret it, is kind of a shift and a demand on us or a request of us to see the laws and the entire maybe conversation of the day that we mapped onto family as actually being laws that deal with how youth and grown-ups interact in society at large, and that those rules that pertain to family maybe have meaning and implication in society at large. The Talmud, I think, ends with a wink, because the Talmud, at one point in its discussion, mentions Avraham. And I wonder what kind of son Abraham was to his father. He clearly was a wild and unruly child to his father, for sure in the way the later Midrashim understand how he acted. And maybe there's a little bit of warning here to society, beware of who you define as wild and unruly, because maybe this is a child that's bringing in something new that will be extremely meaningful, innovative, and important to society. Thank you.